Right, that's just the reviews. Okay. So those are the two main ways. There's a sort of a third way, which is a population code. So, of course, you have lots of neurons, and there are lots of neurons in your retina. So the brighter a light, the more neurons will be recruited to fire. So the brain also interprets that as an increase or decrease in stimulus intensity. So, but in any given cell, it's just the frequency with which action potentials fire and where their axon goes that really encodes virtually everything you know about the world. So let's look at this action potential for a moment and see if we can understand how it arises and how it comes out. So remember I said you can put a microelectrode into a cell and record voltage changes, and if you sort of graph those, I guess, but here's time again in milliseconds. Here's membrane voltage, membrane potential, V sub M. So let's start here at minus 70 millivolts. These are all going to be in, so this is confusing. It's V sub M means membrane voltage, but the units it's in is MV, which is millivolts. So that might be confusing for no particularly good reason, but there it is. So we're talking about millivolts here, thousandths of a volt. So we begin at minus 70, which is sort of the resting potential. We can, another number that will be important here, you can see this is, say, up here, is about plus 20 millivolts, so that puts zero somewhere around there. Okay, so we stick a microelectrode into a cell and we record from it, and it's kind of not doing anything much, like much of my brain cells right now, doodling around there at the resting membrane potential. Minus 70 millivolts, and it varies a little bit, it jitters, but it's mostly minus 70 millivolts. Now let's say at this point here, at time such and such, we input some sort of a stimulus. So let's make it a dim light of some sort if you want, any kind of stimulus at all, it doesn't matter. And then you'll get, the cell will become slightly positive. Now there are two terms here that we have to kind of get straight because they're mildly confusing, all right? So we use the term, we say the membrane is polarized. I used this term polarized the other day about the structure of a cell. Polarized meaning it's got a back and a front, the top and the bottom, something like that. We also say the membrane is polarized because it's not equal voltage across it. It's not 0 volts. So there's some polarization in the membrane. When the membrane becomes more positive, we say it is depolarized. Or we call that a depolarization. So this means it becomes more positive, the membrane voltage. When the membrane is negative, we call this hyperpolarization. So that would be more negative. So a membrane, the resting membrane potential at minus 70 millivolts is hyperpolarized. We say the cell is hyperpolarized, the membrane is hyperpolarized. It's a little sloppy the way we talk about it, but those are the terms you hear. And so in this case, the membrane is sitting at this hyperpolarized level at minus 70 millivolts, and then some stimulus comes along, and the membrane begins to depolarize. Now, in point of fact, depolarized should really only mean it goes closer to zero, which is non-polarized at all. So when we depolarize the membrane, we're moving closer to zero. But in point of fact, the term is used to mean any movement in the positive direction. So even if we were up here at zero and then we went to plus 10, that would still be considered a depolarization. That's not the right meaning of the word. It should be some other kind of polarization, but we don't call it that. Hyperpolarization simply means the membrane is being more polarized, being driven further from zero, but we always take that to mean in the negative direction. Sorry, it's just a convention. It's a bad convention, but it sticks, so there it is. So we say here the membrane depolarizes in response to a stimulus. But let's say the stimulus isn't all that strong. So it depolarizes to maybe, I don't know, minus 60 millivolts, and then the stimulus goes away, and so the membrane just kind of falls back to the resting potential. Nothing much happens. Let's say we make the stimulus just a little bit stronger. So now it depolarizes again, but it just falls back again. Now we give a stronger stimulus and we get it to, let's say, around minus 50 millivolts. And what we find is that if we get it to about minus 50 millivolts, it changes, it's slightly different for different cells, but somewhere in the range of minus 50 to minus 60 millivolts, we hit what's called a threshold. And there's an inflection point here, and quite suddenly, the membrane zooms up past zero. The membrane depolarizes very rapidly past zero millivolts, maybe as high as plus 10 or plus 20 millivolts, reaches a peak, then turns around and almost as fast comes back down, hyperpolarizing now. So we call this the depolarizing phase, and this is the hyperpolarizing phase, because we're going back down negatively. And in point of fact, it goes down below minus 70 millivolts, typically to something close to minus 90 millivolts. And then it relaxes back up to minus 70. So I think I have a handout with some of this on it, but you can draw it as well if you want. So we have first this sort of initial, what's called the graded depolarization, because the depolarization is somehow or another graded in response to the size of the stimulus. The greater the stimulus, the more depolarization you'll get. But these depolarizations that don't reach this threshold in a way don't matter yet. Well, there are. So the question is, what's an example of something that's not sufficiently depolarizing to reach threshold? Because it seems that we can feel light touch and things of that nature, which must be the result of fiber and action potential, which is true. So, but you can go into a very dark room. This is a ridiculous number, but it actually takes about 13 photons in order to fire off enough, to give enough stimulus to your retina to fire an action potential back to the brain. Now, you can get photoreceptor cells that will respond to just one or two photons, but they won't give you enough of a response to get an action potential going. So that's fairly sensitive. 13 photons, that's pretty good. But you have to be very dark adapted to do that. You have to sit in a dark room for about 45 minutes and then have somebody flash a light at your right on your retina that has about 13 photons in it. I know this all sounds like some crazy story, but believe it or not, I don't want to get into it because it's too much of a tangent, but those experiments were actually done here at Columbia in Skirmer one by three psychophysicists, they're called, which does not mean a crazy physicist. That's what it sounds like. There is a field called psychophysics, which is psychology and physics. Really a bad way to have it. Physical psychology would have been smarter. But so they do things like that. The other way, though, that you wouldn't reach threshold would be if you were a neuron sitting somewhere in the middle of your brain, not necessarily getting direct input from sensory systems, but from many other neurons. And it was a mixed input of both positive and negative, as we'll see in synapses, can be either excitatory, positive, or inhibitory, negative. And if you're getting a mixed signal from many other neurons, you may not reach threshold. So that would be another way. You're sort of integrating all these incoming signals, but you don't reach threshold yourself because the balance of positive and negative is more towards the negative. Okay? All right, so since we're good biologists, we name the parts of all of this naturally. So we need a stick here, Deb, not just because I want to push it up further. That'll be an improvement next year. All right, so this point here is called the threshold. This is the rising phase of the action potential. That's easy enough. Or the depolarizing phase. There's a peak up there. That's pretty obvious. Here's the falling phase, or the hyperpolarization. And then down here, where you go below the resting membrane potential, this is called the after hyperpolarization. It's actually got a couple of names. We'll use that one to begin with. The after hyperpolarization, or what's more commonly maybe called the refractory period. And this actually splits up, although you can't see it, this splits up into two periods. The initial part of the refractory period is called the absolute refractory period, and the later part of it is called the relative refractory period. I'll tell you about these in just a moment. Okay, this whole thing, as you know, from the threshold to here happens in about 2 milliseconds. Yes? Yes, so very importantly, the question is, you overshoot the top, by which I mean, I assume you mean you go beyond zero, right?
No, go beyond the plus 20. Like you went below the minus 70.
Right. No, so typically action potentials only get to about plus 10 or plus 20 millivolts. It can vary a little bit, but not much. Now remember what one of the key things about an action potential is we call them invariant, in the sense that every action potential looks pretty much like every other action potential. There are slight differences. I don't want you to get the idea that every one of them has a threshold at minus 50 and they all go to plus 20 and so forth. So there's slight differences because, after all, it's biology. And it depends a little bit on the size of the cell and the particular distribution or the particular collection of channels that are in the membrane of different cells. But for the most part, this is what every action potential in your brain looks like. It certainly follows this form. So there's a threshold, a rising phase, a falling phase, and an after hyperpolarization or refractory period. It's important that it goes above zero because that tells us that, for example, this is not just due to the membrane breaking down. There's some active process here that could get it above zero. If the membrane just broke down or holes appeared in it, then it would also depolarize, but it would only go to zero. So there must be some more active process that allows it to go to plus 20, beyond zero, which is what we're going to talk about in a moment. All right, so it's invariant, which is why the only thing that matters is frequency and pathway in terms of encoding things. All right, and you'll see why it's invariant when we talk about, which we may do right now, we'll talk about how we figure how it actually occurs. So the way we know how it occurs is from a series of classic experiments done by two physiologists named Hodgkin and Huxley in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Using microelectrodes and a somewhat sophisticated technique called voltage clamp, and then a massive amount of calculation and so forth. And he did all this work on preparation called the squid giant axon. So squid, calamari, right, the stuff you eat, squid are well known to have actually the biggest axon of any cell on the planet. So they have this big neuron, they have a giant neuron, and they use it in their escape. They have this sort of ink thing where they push out some ink and then they rapidly fly off in the opposite direction, or swim off, I guess, in the opposite direction. And they do this with this really amounts to a single cell, a huge cell called the giant neuron, and it has this giant axon, this squid giant axon. This axon is a millimeter in diameter, so you can actually see it with the naked eye. I mean, you don't even need a microscope to see it. It doesn't usually come out on the plate. By the time you get calamari on a plate, it's long gone, so you have to go looking for it. But in any case, this axon then was a particularly good preparation to work on to try and figure out how action potentials work, because it's highly conserved process. So it works in the squid just the way it works in us. This, just to take a moment, sort of a slight tangent here, I just want to point out that this is a very important strategy in neuroscience in general, in neuroscience in particular, in biology in general, and in many other sciences as well, and that's the use of what we would call, I suppose, a model system. So, you know, I mentioned that the brain is very complex, right? We all agree with that. And so just studying the brain outright is often not so easy to do. Either we don't have the technology yet to do it, or it's just too complex to figure it out, 100 billion neurons and all that. And so quite often you look in what's called instead a model system, which is something that approximates what you want to find out, but is more more convenient, if you will, experimentally, more tractable experimentally. And the squid giant axon is one of those. I mention this because it's often difficult in science funding for people to understand why it is the National Institutes of Health should be funding people working on squid when theoretically they ought to be curing diseases. But in order to find these sorts of things out, squid turn out to be a very amenable preparation. For many years, my laboratory works in olfaction, a sense of smell, which has a, itself may or may not be of any direct interest, but tells us a lot about how we recognize molecules, which is, tells you about how to design drugs and things like that. So, but we work on salamanders. Now, I don't really care about how salamanders smell, particularly, right? But salamanders have nice big fat cells in their nose. It just turns out that their neurons are bigger than almost any other neuron around. And their olfactory system works much like ours does. And so, and physiologically, they're easier to, preparation is easier to keep, they're cold-blooded, you don't have to keep it warmed up, and all the rest of that sort of thing. So for years, I mean, I would hand in grants with awful-sounding titles like The Molecular Mechanisms of Olfaction in Salamander. And, you know, I can imagine some taxpayer saying, the hell is going on here? I mean, I'm working hard, my tax money is going to figure out how salamanders smell, you know. But that's not the case, and so that's often a problem, I have to say, and you have to go out there and set the world straight about this when you have dinner with your folks or at a cocktail party or something like that. Says, yeah, I heard about this crazy goddamn experiment. These people are, you know, working some stupid thing out on salamanders, and the reason is that these model systems have been extremely effective. So virtually everything I'm going to tell you about today, really, we learned in squid, and we now know it works largely the same way in mammals. Okay. So, Hodgkin and Huxley, using this technique called the voltage clamp, which is a sort of a fancy way of wiring up microelectrodes, were able to look at what was going on with the ionic currents that were creating these voltage changes, right? Because in the end, it had to be the ions, the movement of ions, potassium and sodium, that was changing changing the membrane voltage. All right, so we know that there are equilibrium potentials. We know that the resting membrane potential is made up in some way or another of a combination of channels that are selective to both potassium and sodium in a balance that gives you a resting membrane potential of minus 70 millivolts, which is close to potassium, but not the same as the potassium equilibrium potential. Right, so it must be mostly potassium channels, but some sodium channels. So now the question is, how do you change the membrane voltage? Well, one way you could do it, of course, would be to change the concentrations, right? So you could muck around with the concentrations. You could try and get more potassium outside the cell or more sodium inside the cell, and that would certainly change the membrane potential. But that would take a long time. That would be a very slow process. It would take a long time, and then it would be very difficult to get the concentrations back to where you wanted them again here. So the magic trick really is that cells manage to do this simply by changing the number of channels that are open, the number and type of channels that are open. And when you change the balance of channels, then you change this membrane potential to be whatever, well, to move towards the equilibrium potential of the most channels that are open. Let me see if I can say that in a little less confusing a way. So what you're really doing is moving the membrane potential either towards the potassium equilibrium potential or the sodium equilibrium potential. And if you think about the Nernst equation, the easiest way to do that is to simply open more sodium channels or open more potassium channels. And by changing the balance of those two channels, you can push the membrane back and forth. Because channels open and close very quickly, or can, then you can see how this would work very rapidly. So the important thing to remember is that there's actually very little change in the actual concentration of the ions. You don't have to move many ions back and forth. You really get these changes in voltage by changing the selective permeability of the cell, changing the ratio of sodium to potassium. So let me, there's a diagram at the bottom of the handout for today. So let me suggest to you how that sort of works. It's on what? Oh, 17B. All right. So let's begin. Sort of circular thing, so one never knows exactly where to begin. But let's start with it with this the way it shows up on the handout. So here is depolarization. This is caused by some input, whether it's a sensory input or some other cells are inputting into you, some other synapses are firing. So you begin with this depolarization. That's this part here. So as you depolarize the membrane, sodium channels, what are called voltage-gated sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels. Okay? So that simply means that the sodium channels in the membrane are sensitive to voltage. At hyperpolarized levels, they're not open very often. They're mostly closed. But when they detect the voltage becoming depolarized, when they detect the depolarization, they begin opening. And they tend to open right around this region here. This is where they're most sensitive, in this minus 50 to minus 60 millivolt range. So what happens is you depolarize, and you get, so the term we use for this is conductance, which is a G, G sub NA. G sub, so this is the sodium conductance. Now, I told you the channels have a conductance, individual channels have a conductance, and that's true. But what we're talking about here is actually the whole cell conductance, not the conductance of a single channel. So this is a measure of how many sodium channels are open in the cell membrane. And so, in response to depolarization, some sodium channels open. Because that's what they do. That's the way the protein works. So their gate comes open, and of course sodium flows into the cell. So we say that's the sodium current. We use the symbol I for current. Okay, so G is conductance. You know, this is really just Ohm's law, right? Conductance is the inverse of resistance. So if it was Ohm's law, it would be voltage equals current times resistance. But resistance is just 1 over conductance, okay? So it's the same thing. It's just, but it's easier to think of it as conductance because this is a measure of the ease with which sodium gets in the cell. And that simply results from the number of sodium channels that are open. All right, so now, so you increase the number of sodium channels that are open, and that allows you to get more sodium ions flowing into the cell. Well, more sodium ions flowing into the cells results in greater depolarization. So the voltage gets more positive. Well, as the voltage gets more positive, more sodium channels open because they're sensitive to positive voltage. More sodium channels open, you get more sodium ions flowing through them into the cell. What does that do? Depolarizes the cell some more. So you get yourself locked into this, it's called a positive feedback cycle. This is sort of how explosions occur. And that's why you get this, if you will, explosive and rapid rise in the membrane potential. Because what's happened here, right at this threshold, you've now got just enough sodium channels open to get the cell to a place where more sodium comes in, depolarization, more sodium channels open, etc. So you get into this positive feedback cycle. And it becomes literally explosive. So you get this rapid increase in voltage. Well, this is all good, fine. Tells you how you get this fast increase in the depolarization, but obviously this can't go on forever because you kind of run out of sodium or explode or something like that, right? So, and clearly you can see the action potential stops at some point, it reaches a peak, and then begins to fall again. So what happens? Well, it turns out that depolarization also will open potassium channels, but potassium channels have a higher threshold. Potassium channels don't begin opening until around minus 20 millivolts. And they're slow. Sodium channels are really fast. Once they decide to open, they snap open quickly. Potassium channels are a little bit more sluggish. It takes a bit more voltage, and they're not quite as responsive to voltage. It's just the way the protein is made. So the gate on a potassium channel is a little slower to open, and it's not as sensitive to voltage. But they also open in response to depolarization. And so when the depolarization gets to about minus 20 or so millivolts, you begin increasing the potassium conductance. And when you increase the potassium conductance, of course, you allow more potassium ions to flow as well. Which way are potassium ions going to flow? Still a high concentration inside the cell. And now, it's more positive in the cell, right? It's not down here at the equilibrium potential. It's not even at the resting membrane potential. It's up here at minus 20, minus 30, 0, plus 10 millivolts. So which way do potassium ions want to flow? They want to flow out. They want to get the hell out of there. Not only is it crowded inside the cell, because there's a lot of potassium, but it's really positive in there. So if virtually expelled from the cell. So they begin flowing out of the cell. Well, as positive ions now flow out of the cell, this leads to a hyperpolarization of the membrane, right? And so now the membrane hyperpolarizes. So this is a sort of a negative feedback cycle. It's attached to the positive feedback cycle. So by putting these two things together, you can get this explosive and rapid increase of depolarization, but then that's followed by an almost as rapid hyperpolarization. So there's one other thing you need to know in here, which is that sodium channels are sort of like a mouse trap. Once they open, they can stay open for a while, but then they'll close. And in order to reopen again, they have to experience a negative voltage. They have to kind of be reset. So at some point, you begin running out of sodium channels. So at some point up in here, you've opened a ton of sodium channels, and now they begin closing. And so, but the number of potassium channels that are open increases. And so a little bit now, potassium takes over from sodium. And that's why you don't actually get to plus 50 millivolts up here. If all you had was sodium channels opening and no potassium channels at all, then this membrane would eventually reach the sodium equilibrium potential, right? You'd be in a situation where you had a cell with nothing but a sodium permeability. That doesn't happen. It only gets to plus 20 for two reasons, mostly. One is you begin running out of sodium channels, and two, the potassium channels take over. And so you reach this peak, and then it begins dropping back down again. So this is almost due exclusively now to potassium channels opening. And of course, now as you hyperpolarize, sodium, whatever sodium channels were still around and are open begin closing, because in response to voltage, they're closed at negative voltages. They're closed at hyperpolarization and open at depolarization. So now even those that are open are beginning to close. And so the whole thing is taken over by potassium, and indeed, the after hyperpolarization is due to the fact that you have virtually no sodium channels open here. It's all potassium channels, and so the membrane actually does get almost down to the potassium equilibrium potential. But you now have a situation with a cell that is almost exclusively permeable only to potassium. Now, once you get down to this very negative voltage, these sodium channels that were like a mousetrap begin to reset. They don't open, but they're available to open, because they've been now experience a very negative voltage. And so they're brought back online, and a few of them do begin to open, just as a result of sort of thermal agitation, I mean, just the temperature and instability. And so a few of them open, and so you relax back to this resting membrane potential, which you remember is a combination of mostly potassium channels, but a few sodium channels as well. And so you now get back to this resting membrane potential. Okay so far? So the key here is, the important thing to recognize is this whole rapid change in voltage occurs really because we're flipping back and forth between opening sodium channels and closing them and opening potassium channels and closing them. And so the membrane just flies towards the sodium equilibrium potential and then back towards the potassium equilibrium potential. Doesn't reach either of them. But whichever channel is dominating the population of open channels, that's where the membrane is going to go. Yes? There's a question about inactivated versus closed sodium channels, but we're not. So sodium channels, you don't. I don't know what you mean by worry about it. Yeah, you should worry about it, because if they didn't do that, some of this wouldn't work. But what he's referring to is, I don't know how much you, did you talk about sodium channels inactivating? So I wouldn't worry about it. Just think of channels as opened or closed. In some cases, I mean, the idea of the mousetrap is that they not only close, but they're inactive. We call it inactivated until you reactivate them, until you reset them, which happens by being very hyperpolarized. But this is a sort of a channelology thing that I don't think you need to worry about to understand the actual potential yet.
So both of those things.
The question is, think the question is, when I talk about the time limit of sodium channels, is it that sodium channels just have a certain time that they're open and then close, which is true, or do you run out of sodium channels? You do both of those things. So once you activate these sodium channels, their gate opens, but then it swings shut, as I say, just like a kind of a mousetrap, and it'll stay shut. So they're out of the population, they're out of the available population, until the cell gets very hyperpolarized, which is, in the mousetrap analogy, the same thing as resetting it, so it can flip off again. So both things happen. These sodium channels open and close relatively rapidly, and as a result of their now being unavailable, you run out of sodium channels, or you begin to run out of sodium channels. The main point really is that the number of potassium channels overtakes the number of open sodium channels. And so that's what drags the membrane back down to its hyperpolarized state. Yeah.
How does that reset the pre-action potential?
The ionic gradient? Right, so this is actually a rather important question, because I know what I've given you the impression is that all these channels open and ions are sloshing in and sloshing out of the cell, potassium's, sodium's coming in and potassium's going out, and it looks like you'd have to move a lot of ions around to get these changes, but that's the magic trick part of this. Virtually no ions flow. I mean, very, very few ions actually flow in or out through these channels. It just doesn't take many to change the voltage. That may not be immediately intuitive, but for example, so and eventually you do have to reset it. There's something called the sodium potassium pump, which runs on ATP and will pump potassium back into the cell and sodium out of the cell to restore whatever concentration gradients there are. But here's the experiment that was done. So there's a drug. I think it's colchicine. Is it colchicine? Anyway, there's a drug you can put on a preparation that poisons the pump. So this eight... Oh, it's Wabi. Yeah. Sorry, Wabi. Uh-oh. I don't know how to spell Wabi. Don't worry about it. I can't remember how to spell it. Anyway, so these experiments were done a long time ago, but I haven't read about them in a while. But anyway, you can poison the sodium-potassium pump. And so you can have a cell sitting in a dish, you have your microelectrode in it, and you stimulate it. Let's just say you stimulate it electrically. You put a second microelectrode in, which keeps delivering little electrical pulses that would drive it past thresholds, so it fires action potentials. And then you put a drug in the dish, this Wabane, which poisons the pump, so the ATP-driven pump no longer works. So how many action potentials then can you fire before these concentration gradients run down? Anybody want to guess? Anybody know? About 150,000. 150,000 action potentials before the gradients run down too far to support an action potential happening. So you can see that there aren't many ions changing back and forth. And if you think about it, even in something as small as a cell, which is maybe has a volume of, I don't know, 200 femtoliters or something like that. This is something you can play around with if you want to feel like working out on a calculator. But take 140 millimolar potassium, right, which is the inside concentration of potassium, I think. Take 140 millimolar potassium and figure out how many ions that is in a 25 or a 200 femtoliter volume. And you'll see that it's a vast number of ions. And so actually to change the concentrations to get these voltage changes would be virtually impossible. You'd really have to move a ton of ions to get enough of a change in the concentration gradient to change the membrane potential. That's why this business of just altering the selective permeabilities is the trick to having a rapid signaling system.
How does, without the ATP or the NA,
well, the resting membrane potential doesn't depend on the pump. The resting membrane potential only depends on the ratio of sodium and potassium channels that are open. So it gets back to the resting membrane potential after this hyperpolarization because a few sodium channels begin opening. So you're once again in a situation where you have mostly potassium channels and a few sodium channels open, and so you move away from the equilibrium potential of potassium. Slightly more than polarized level. But the pump doesn't really add much to this.
Right, you're saying that the difference that you're creating with the difference in the potentials, you know, to different sides.
Right.
It's basically so sensitive to tiny bits of the ion that you're saying with the channels that you're not really moving the ions.
Right. So now maybe I've gone too far the other way. Ions do flow through these channels. There is some movement of ions. It just doesn't take very many. Okay, you don't actually have to change the concentration. So the trouble is the Nernst equation would lead you to believe that it's the C2 over C1, the concentration inside versus outside, which is what sets the voltage. And that's true. That's what sets the equilibrium voltage for each of the ions, for potassium or for sodium. But the membrane voltage doesn't require you to change the concentrations of the ions. All you have to do is switch from sodium to potassium and you'll move closer or further away from either of their equilibrium potentials. So imagine a perfect cell. Imagine a cell. You have two cells. One cell has only potassium channels and it's at minus 90 millivolts. The other cell has only sodium channels and it's at plus 50 millivolts. And they can't move, right? They're stuck there. They're at equilibrium. But now you have a cell that has both sets of channels. And by just flipping back and forth between the two sets of channels, you can move the membrane closer to whichever equilibrium potential has the most channels open. Does that make sense at all? I know this is a little tricky because it's very unintuitive, but it's a neat trick if you ask me. I don't know if guaifenesin is an anesthetic or not. I mean, they're not permanent. You can wash the stuff out, so it's not permanent. But I don't think that would, as I say, you still get 150,000 action potentials even if you poison the pump. So you really wouldn't be, the idea of an anesthetic would be that the neuron no longer fires action potentials if it was, say, a pain fiber or something like that. But it would fire 150,000 action potentials. You'd have to wait around a long time before you started the operation. It wouldn't, I think, work as an anesthetic. Yeah.
That same way, I think, anesthetics, they just stop channels.
If what?
Anesthetics, they just block channels.
Well, the question is, do anesthetics block channels? So the ugly fact is that 150 years since the beginning of the use of anesthetics of various sorts, we haven't got the slightest idea how they work, for the most part. It's one of those things. Some of them we do. So, for example, lidocaine, which is, sort of like Novocaine, blocks sodium channels. So that we know. And it also blocks some other synaptic channels. But most general anesthetics, we actually have no good idea how they work. There are all sorts of cockamamie ideas out there. We don't know how they work. Alcohol is another one. We don't know how alcohol works. So we don't really understand how it has the effect that it has on our mental capacity or state. But it's almost surely involved in channels somewhere. Somebody will figure out quite what or how. Yes?
So, the sodium potential, if the equilibrium capacity is minus 90, you have to spend energy to move to minus 70, right?
Yes.
So, is that what the NaK pump
is? Yes. So, the question is, so remember, I mentioned this the other day, that minus 70 millivolts, the resting membrane potential, is not an equilibrium potential, and it won't stay there by itself. It will eventually run down, and that's what the pump is for. So, the sodium potassium pump maintains the concentration so that the resting membrane potential is maintained. But it's very easy for it to keep up with this. That's the point. You have a bunch of these pumps, so they work sort of slow. They're much slower than channels. They actually work like a pump. And so you can't change the membrane potential rapidly with these pumps. They're just there to kind of keep the bookkeeping straight, as it were. But it's the channels that really do the trick. I'm sorry, just what? With
eight.
Oh. Well, so the question is about ADHD, and I don't really know. I don't think anybody knows exactly. I mean, they have action potentials. It's not like they don't have action potentials, but they still have them. They have them in the wrong place. They have too many of them, too few of them. I mean, there are lots of diseases that affect action potentials. We'll talk about one in a moment. But in general, this is still going on in any brain. Schizophrenics, bipolar, normal, whatever the hell that is, all the rest of that. Everybody's got action potentials. It's where they're going and how fast they're going and things like that. But this mechanism in general does not change. Mutations that mess around with sodium and potassium channels are almost always embryonic lethal. So they don't show up in the population in general. Okay? So one comparison one might make to this. You remember I told you that the Greeks and Romans thought the brain was largely a hydraulic instrument, and there is some plumbing up there. So one way of thinking about an action potential actually is this kind of slightly bizarre but true analogy with flushing a toilet. So here's the way you can think about an action potential, right? So you know, you get to a toilet, you can sort of play with it. You can play with the handle a little bit, and you can sort of start it and then pull back, right? You get a little bit, but you don't really get a flush out of it, you know? And you get a little bit more than that. But at some point you go, oh, I'm over the limit. And once you hit that threshold, right, then you get a flush. That's it. And so that's the depolarization. You get that big flush, right? And then things fill back up again, right? I mean, the flush part of it goes off. Those pipes, those channels close. And now new channels open and the water fills back up again. You even have this after hyperpolarization period where you can't get... So this is critical because in this after hyperpolarization, you can't get another action potential here. So this ensures that for this brief period of time, you can't get another action potential no matter what the stimulus is. And there's this absolute refractory period in the beginning where no matter what you do, you won't get one. And then there's this relative refractory period where sort of enough sodium channels have come back online that if you really use a much bigger stimulus than the normal one, you will be able to fire another action potential, but it's much harder. That's the same thing with the toilet, right? I mean, after it flushes, you know, there's that period of time where you can crank it all you want and you're just not going to get a second flush out of it, right? I mean, it's completely refractory. But if you're impatient and you really got to get moving, so you wait a little while, and, you know, if you really crank it good, you can kind of get a second, not great flush, but you can get a great, you can get the job done. So and that's the relative refractory period. So you see, it's all hydraulics, that's all. And actually, if you think about it a little bit, there's more to that than you might think, believe it or not. I mean, this idea of opening one set of channels and then opening another set of channels gets you back and forth here. In any case, it's very similar. So you see, the brain is a bit hydraulic. All right, have I made enough sense with this? I feel like I've confused you as much as anything else. It's a little bit unintuitive, and it's worth thinking over a bit and reading about, because it's a very neat sort of, I keep calling it a neat trick, because I'm always amazed that it really works so well, that you can get this very rapid, very reliable, what we call all or nothing, invariant sort of signal. That travels at a very rapid speed. I mean, remember, you're doing this in milliseconds. And it's just simply a question of going back and forth between two different species of channels. If more sodium channels open, you get depolarization. If you have more potassium channels open, you get more hyperpolarization. Okay so far? So now you have an action potential. So what use is all this? I mean, if it doesn't go anywhere, if you can have cells firing action potentials, who cares? They have to somehow or another, this information has to get moved around. So the next thing to consider, I suppose, is what we call propagation, how you get an action potential moving around. So the trick is, of course, you want this action potential to go down the axon, to propagate down the axon. So we call this... propagation. And what this means basically is that once the action potential starts, you want it to travel down the axon to what eventually will be the synaptic terminal. And there's also a piece on the second handout about this. So you have the quickly, the neuron here. Here's the neuron. Here's the axon. There's this region right here, just as the axon is emanating from the cell body, called the axon hillock, or sometimes the initial segment. Both those words are used. And it's a region of the membrane that's loaded with sodium channels, loaded with voltage-gated sodium channels. So if the cell depolarizes sufficiently to reach that threshold, an action potential will be initiated, typically right here. And that action potential then will travel down the axon at significant speed, something like 20 meters per second. It can run down the axon. The axon is full of sodium channels as well. And so there's a neat trick that's used mostly in mammals. One of the reasons the squid has this giant axon is that the bigger the axon, the thicker this pipe, the faster the action potential can travel. I mean, it's, again, kind of hydraulics. If you have a bigger pipe, you can push more water down it, right? So one way to get action potentials to travel very fast is to have big, thick axons. That's okay if you're a squid and you need only one big, thick axon like to get away, and all the other axons would be small ones and work slower. But for us, that doesn't work so well. So when you begin trying to pack a lot of neurons into a brain and each one of them has an axon, you can't have these big, thick axons. So another solution to that is to insulate the axons. And that's done with a substance called myelin, which is secreted from a kind of glial cell that wraps itself around the axon and secretes this substance called myelin, which is a fatty, lipid-like substance. So it's a very good insulator. It's essentially like insulating the wire. So this prevents ions from leaking out all the way along the axon, because if it did that, then this thing wouldn't get very far. It wouldn't be able to propagate. And so you have this, so I'm sort of showing this now in cross-section, you have this cell that's wrapped itself around the axon, and so sort of this is what's sort of shown on the drawing. So here's this myelin sheath, and importantly, there are breaks in this myelin sheath every so often. Because it also wouldn't work if the whole thing was just covered in myelin. What happens at these breaks, which are called nodes of Ranvier, because a French physiologist named Ranvier discovered them, is that right here, in these exposed parts of the axon, it's loaded with sodium and potassium channels. Voltage-gated sodium and potassium channels are directed to this part of the axon. So you have these all the way down. And you have these nodes all the way down. And what this effectively does is it allows the action potential to jump from one node to the next. And this increases the speed significantly. So the way to think about this is sort of like a fuse. The way a fuse works, the reason you can have a fuse that can go, a fuse can go a mile. You can have a fuse going for quite a long distance. And the reason is that a fuse actually has segment after segment in it. If you look at it carefully, it's made up of actually small little segments all stuck together. And when you light one end of the fuse, it heats up the next segment, which then goes off, which heats up the next segment, which then goes off, which heats up the next segment. And so actually the flame jumps down the fuse, segment by segment. It's hard to see that because fuses are packed very tightly. But that's what's going on. And that's why at the end of the fuse, you can light it here, and at the end of the fuse, you still have the same temperature that you lit it at here at this end of it. There's no diminution in the temperature because at every segment, it pops up again, right? It's reignited. This is different, say, than a long piece of string. You light a piece of string, it goes for a little while, and it just burns out. So you can't use string for a fuse. Same thing here. So at each point, the action potential runs to here, and then it depolarizes this membrane sufficiently now to reach threshold. Oops, sorry. To reach threshold and another action potential. And that action potential then will travel about that far and depolarizes this membrane sufficiently to fire yet another action potential. And each one of these action potentials, again, is invariant. So even though you have this axon that goes 3 feet or so to your big toe, by the time it reaches your big toe, the action potential that comes out of the end of it is exactly the same size as the one that went in all the way back at the cell body. So this is a sort of a critical development. In myelin, so when you look at a cross-section of a brain, you know, in pictures, you see the sort of what's called the gray area and the white matter. The gray area is this sort of thin bit at the top, and then there's all this white stuff underneath it. And the white stuff is myelin. So white matter in the brain is our axons, or all the cables, all the axons from the cells. The gray matter are the cell bodies. So the cell bodies sit up near the surface of the brain, and their axons travel back and forth slightly deeper and make up what's called the white matter, because myelin is a very white, shiny substance. It looks like mayonnaise. Kind of works like mayonnaise, too. There are diseases of the myelin that are very important. The most well-known, I suppose, is multiple sclerosis. So multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease where your immune system suddenly decides it doesn't like the look of myelin and attacks it. And it destroys the myelin, and as a result of that, the conduction velocities down your nerves are dysregulated. And this is what causes the spasmodic movement and so forth in muscular and multiple sclerosis. And generally diseases, motor diseases like that, that have some kind of spasmodic movement or uncontrolled movements associated with them, turn out to be diseases of conduction velocity, which are often the result of some problem with the myelin. Yeah?
MS, is the myelin in both the peripheral and central nervous systems affected, or is it just peripheral?
It's mostly peripheral, but I think there's also some effect in the central as well. Yeah, they're slightly different, but I think they're both. Pretty sure both get affected. Yes?
How often do you get to branching with the axons?
Yes, so they'll travel right down the branch exactly the same. I mean, it would be sort of like putting a fuse together with another fuse and branching it, then you'll get two perfectly good conductions now out of it. So, right, so in the branching, you don't get any diminution, you don't get any fading out or anything like that. So once this action potential is fired up here in the initial segment, it's pretty faithfully communicated, even over quite long distances. And so that's actually what the reason, in the sense that there's any kind of a reason for any of this. So the value of having the action potential being invariant and of this form is that it can go very fast over long distances very reliably. So whatever you give up by not having like half action potentials for smaller stimuli or things like that, you gain back in this notion of fast, reliable, and invariant signaling over long distances.
So you're saying that
like convulsive disorders and epilepsy is also combined with the myelin, or is it a combination of these? No, so the question about convulsive disorders like epilepsy. So that's different. Convulsions or compulsive disorders are generally, well, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of them, but they're generally not myelin-associated, no. No. So myelin-associated diseases would be much more permanent than a simple convulsion from which you then recover and everything's normal again. That's why something like MS is permanent damage.
Insulating the axons.
What
exactly are we insulating? Since the channels are in one specific spot, there's not
going to be any leakage. Well, so yes and no. I mean, these things do leak. I mean, so all this work, believe it or not, comes from the work of Lord Kelvin, and this was based on trying to run a cable from New York to London, the transatlantic cable for telegraph. And the question was, well, you're sending electrical signals down a very long cable, in this case about 2,000 miles long, which is a long cable, and there's going to be a certain amount of leakage because it's sitting in seawater, which is highly conductive. And that's what these axons are sitting in, right? I mean, they're sitting in your solution, which is, you know, if you taste it, it's kind of salty, right? So there's a highly conductive solution outside the cell membrane, loaded up with sodium ions and chloride ions. And so although the lipid itself is an insulator, it's not a perfect insulator. And so things would leak out of it. There'd be the stray channel here or there, and there are leak channels and all these other things. So it's a kind of a leaky pipe. And it's the same way, I mean, so Lord Kelvin had to work out how wide the cable had to be and how much insulation had to be around it in order to get a signal that went in New York to come out in London and still be recognizable. It's the same issue, really. So, oddly enough, all the equations that were worked out for laying the transatlantic cable were used here. What we call it cable theory, in fact, is how you work this out. Remarkable.
If the muscle ball is long, you load the temperature. Point, where the resistance would be lowered, so you still get some product. Does that help at all?
The question has to do with temperature effects if myelin were all gone. I don't know, but that wouldn't be a very comfortable cure, would it? I don't think it would. I think you'd still have a dysregulation of production velocity. I mean, the important thing is not just the speed, it's also the fact that you have a lot of fibers working together. So many of these fibers are packed together in nerves, right? I mean, we're talking about a single axon, but they typically fasciculate as groups of axons in nerves, and they're all wrapped in myelin as well. So that's all, you need to have all of that sort of working together. I think it's the product. I think it's actually the myelin itself that's destroyed. I'm not positive of that, but I think that's the case, yeah.
What's the lifetime of myelin?
The lifetime of myelin? I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, it's produced by glial cells, and I assume it's replaced as needed. You can generate more myelin. I mean, if you damage a nerve or things like that, it's not... So the myelin is not part of the neuron. It comes from glial cells. And glial cells can divide and things like that. They're a little bit more repairable than neurons. But I don't actually know how much myelin is regenerated or what its lifetime is. Yeah, so there's some difference in the size of fibers. Pain fibers in particular come in different sizes, and that depends on their conduction velocity. So some pain fibers you want very fast conduction, obviously, like if you touch something hot, you want to know that right away to take your hand away. But other pain fibers are much slower, so there's a kind of throbbing pain or pain I have in my back right now, things like that. That goes slower but more constantly. Instead of being fast. So yes, so there are differences. Not all action potentials travel down every nerve at the same rate. Things are made differently. And whether it's in the peripheral nervous system or the central nervous system makes a difference because there are different distances to travel. All right, one more question, because otherwise you're not going to get any answers here. Yes.
Part of the axon that's myelinated, are there ions?
Inside the part of the axon that's myelinated, so ions are being pushed down this fiber, and that's how. So the sodium ions that come in here have to go somewhere, and what they do is they go this way, and then they depolarize the next segment, and then you get the action potential. Why don't they go that way? Why do you have an action potential here? Sodium channels come in, sodium ions come in, and the depolarization spreads further down the nerve to the next node of Ranvier. Why doesn't it go backwards? Anybody? The what? Refractory period, right? So that's why the refractory period in the action potential is so important, because here you can't get the toilet flushed again, right? So because of that refractory period, because this membrane, once it fires that action potential, is now refractory to being fired on again. And so it can only go this way. I mean, the depolarization will spread both ways, in fact, but it won't have any effect when it goes backwards. So that's what keeps the action potential moving in one direction. That's really the critical importance of the refractory period. Okay. Let's do synapses before we're out of time, okay? All right, so now the axon. So we've gotten ourselves to the point where we have an action potential. We figured out how it's generated. We get an action potential generated in the cell in response to some kind of input. It's now ready to send this information down the axon to some other cell, to the synapse in some other cell. And that's the critical, really, in the end, the really critical thing, because if you know something, that's fine. But if you don't tell anybody, doesn't really amount to anything, right? So it's critical for a cell to say, I'm excited, I think you ought to be excited too. Or, I'm not so excited, maybe you should calm down, whatever the case may be. But it does that at the synapse, right? All right, so what happens at the synapse? So it comes down here, and then we have this big synaptic structure, and you have this horrifyingly complicated drawing hand out there, but I'm going to try and simplify this just a little bit. So the first thing is, are these synapses electrical or chemical? And this was a big debate for quite a long time. Because it seemed like everything was electrical, so why wouldn't it just, why did you get an action potential here? I mean, this is a very close, wasn't even sure there was a cleft in here. So this space here is 20 to 40 nanometers. So that's below the level of much microscopy. You can't actually see that space unless you use an electron microscope. So it wasn't clear whether these cells were touching each other at the synapse or whether there really was this space. So it's quite possible, you could imagine, that this action potential comes barreling down the axon, hits the synapse, and then jumps into the next cell. It just depolarizes the membrane of the next cell and says, go ahead, fire away. Turns out that's not the way it works. And there was a kind of a critical experiment by a fellow named Otto Lowy, who the story is that he dreamt this experiment and woke him up in the middle of the night, dreamt this experiment, and he thought, okay, I can't wait to get the lab tomorrow to do it. And he woke up the next morning, he couldn't remember the dream. So he forgot this critical experiment that he devised. So, and then about a week later, apparently, he had the dream again, and he got up and went to the lab and did the experiment in the middle of the night. Because he was, why didn't he write it down? I don't know. That's the story. Anyway, so here's the experiment that he did. He did it using a frog heart, as it turns out. So muscle, by that time, everybody knew muscles also use action potentials, and that's how they work. So muscles are activated by action potentials, and they support action potentials themselves. They have sodium, potassium channels in them and so forth. All right, so here's Lowy's experiment. Don't draw this till I sort of get finished with it, or else you'll make him, because I have to erase something midway through it. All right, so here's Lowy's experiment. So he takes that frog, and he takes the heart out of the frog, and he puts the frog heart in a beaker with all the right saline in it. Okay? And he watches the heart beat, because as you know, the heart will beat without any nerve supply. So hearts beat on their own. That's why you can transplant them, because they'll maintain a regular beat all on their own. Even though there is a nerve supply that modulates that, they'll beat all on their own. So we watch this heart beat, and it would just beat away like that, okay? Hold on, I just need to think about this for 1 second. So the heart beats away on its own, right? Okay. Then he took another... Right, okay. So then you also can take an electrode. You can stick an electrode into the heart. We'll just call it a wire at this point, okay? So you can stimulate this heart and make it beat faster. So now it'll beat... No, I'm sorry. So actually, when you stimulate the heart, so there's the 10th nerve, the so-called vagal nerve, and when you stimulate it, it actually slows the beat down. So it modulates the heartbeat, slowing it down. So the question was, so here he is, he's stimulating this nerve, the vagus nerve, which innervates the heart. And when he stimulates it, the heart slows down. So the question is this electrical or is it a chemical synapse between the motor neuron, the nerve here, and the heart muscle itself? Okay? And here's the experiment. So then he takes another heart, puts it in a beaker over here, but this is the erasing part. Now you can draw this if you want. Okay. So now here's another heart here, which has been denervated. There's no nerve on it. It's just the heart all by itself in this beaker. But there's a connection between the two beakers. So the solutions can easily diffuse. And so now he watches this heart, which is beating away. And at the time that he stimulates this heart here, nothing happens for a little while. But then, after some seconds, this heart over here begins to slow down as well. So what this said to Lowy was that when he stimulates the nerve, it's producing some transmitter, some chemical, which he in fact called vagus stuff. Because what else are you going to call it? It comes from the vagus nerve and it seemed to be some stuff or another. So it's vagus stuff is what it was originally called. It since turned out to be acetylcholine. So we now know what the chemical is. But the notion was that stimulating this nerve here electrically caused it to fire action potentials, caused the release of some chemical which acted on the heart to slow it down. And because these two chambers were connected, whatever that substance was able to diffuse from this chamber to this one and slow this heart down as well, which had no electrical input at all. No nerve input at all. And so this suggested that there had to be a diffusible neurotransmitter. And indeed, that is the case. So in general, most synapses, although there are a few synapses that work by direct electrical connection, called gap junctions, most of them work this way. And so the structure of the synapse is fairly simple. Let me just quickly give you a couple of terms for it. Understand where we're going. All right, so this part of the synapse, the so-called synaptic bouton, the synaptic ending, this is called the presynaptic terminal. Presynaptic terminal. And then where the synapse is occurring, this is now the dendrite, presumably, or the soma of the next cell in line, this is known as the postsynaptic side of it, or the postsynaptic, sometimes called membrane. Postsynaptic cell, postsynaptic membrane, anything like that. There's presynaptic and postsynaptic, and then there is what's called the synaptic cleft. And this is a definitive space, about 20 to 40 nanometers in size. So quite often you'll have nerve cells that are very closely packed, and their membranes are actually touching each other, and then they come apart slightly to make this synaptic cleft. So this is actually a part in the cells. The space is sort of a critical part of the synapse. Inside the presynaptic membrane are vesicles. And these vesicles contain molecules of neurotransmitter. I'll talk about the transmitters in a moment. There are also, in the membrane here, numerous channels. And these are voltage-gated calcium channels. So they're opened by voltage, depolarization opens these channels, and they're permeable to calcium. Now, calcium is a very interesting and important ion. Calcium outside the cell exists at a concentration of about 5 millimolar. But calcium is a very dangerous ion because of the two positive charges on it. It's poison to cells. So cells pump it out at a high rate and maintain a very, very low concentration inside, about 0.1 millimole, 10 to the minus 7th or so. So inside the cell is very low calcium. Cells have taken advantage of this to make calcium a very good signaling molecule. So briefly having calcium in a cell is okay. And because you have this huge concentration gradient, this is much larger than the concentration gradient for sodium or potassium, right? This is orders of magnitude difference. If a calcium channel opens, you'll get a significant influx of calcium, changing the concentration of calcium by as much as an order of magnitude, up to a millimolar briefly or something like that. And then it's pumped out very quickly. The result of that is that calcium acts on these vesicles and causes them to fuse with the plasma membrane. Now, there are a whole slew of proteins that are all involved in this. I'm not going to go into all those details. But basically, the influx of calcium causes these vesicles to move towards the presynaptic membrane and to fuse with it in such a way that the transmitter substance is released by exocytosis now into the synaptic cleft. So action potential comes down, depolarizes the synaptic terminal, the presynaptic terminal, calcium channels open, vesicles full of neurotransmitter fuse with the plasma membrane and open. The neurotransmitter comes out and simply diffuses across the synaptic cleft. In the postsynaptic membrane, you have receptors that are sensitive to this neurotransmitter. And when the neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, it causes one of two things to happen. So there are two kinds of receptor here. There are what are called ionotropic receptors. These are ion channels that are gated by a ligand, that are gated by the neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter binds to the protein, and that causes the channel to open. They're not voltage dependent. They don't care what the voltage is. But if there's a ligand there, if there's a neurotransmitter there that binds to them, they'll open. There's also what's called a metabotropic receptor. And these are receptors that also need ligand to bind to them, but they're not ion channels. They're just receptors, and they utilize a second messenger system, which I'm sure you've discussed. Typically, they're connected to a G protein that makes, that activates a cyclase, that makes cyclic AMP, and cyclic AMP activates some other enzyme, which eventually activates channels as well, causing this cell to change its membrane potential. So it can either be direct, this is of course much faster, and so much of the signaling is ionotropic, but the metabotropic receptors are important because they kind of modulate the state of the cell. What are these, neurotransmitters? Well, the most important ones turn out to be amino acids. And among those, glutamate is the most important excitatory transmitter. So if this synapse releases glutamate, then there are glutamate receptors here. They're typically ionotropic glutamate receptors. A channel opens and positive ions can flow through those channels, thereby depolarizing this membrane. And if enough of them open, or there are enough synapses all at once releasing glutamate onto the cell, and enough of these ionotropic channels open, the cell will depolarize to the point where it can fire an active potential. Glutamate is the major positive or excitatory transmitter in the central nervous system. The other major transmitter is called GABA, which stands for gamma-aminobutyric acid, which you don't have to worry about. But GABA is the major inhibitory transmitter. So, if instead this terminal has vesicles full of GABA and it's released, it binds to an ionotropic receptor that opens a channel that allows chloride to come into the cell. Chloride is a negative ion, and this causes the postsynaptic cell then to hyperpolarize, to become less active. So it may have a mix of inputs. There may be some synapses that have glutamate and some synapses that have GABA. And depending on which ones are firing in excess, the cell will either depolarize or hyperpolarize and eventually integrate the two of them together and decide whether it can reach threshold for an action potential or not. There are a number of other transmitters that mostly work at metabotropic receptors, and you've heard of all of these. They're all derived from amino acids through some biochemical pathway. And they include serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine or epinephrine, sometimes called adrenaline. So those are the major amino acid-derived neurotransmitters, and they're mostly metabotropic. Whoops. That's my phone, I'm sorry. That is, believe it or not, my wife. A little embarrassing, I guess. But you got to know, you know. Okay. You should hear my mother's ring. Stillborn! Something like that, anyway. Okay. Sorry. There's also the final transmitter to know is acetylcholine. Choline is also kind of an amino acid, but this works a little differently. Acetylcholine is the major positive or excitatory transmitter in the peripheral nervous system. So it runs all your muscles and things like that. Okay, so any quick questions about this? I'm sorry to race through it like that, but this is, we have actually gotten most of it. Okay. There are, believe it or not, now these so-called gaseous neurotransmitters. Nitric oxide and some other gases can work as neurotransmitters. And although I don't have time now to tell you the whole story, that's actually the basis of Viagra. Now, that's it. Now you'll go read about that, I'm sure. Any quick questions? What's the point of an inhibitory neurotransmitter? About 30% of the synapses in your brain are inhibitory. And if you didn't have those, you'd be running around with epilepsy and convulsions most of the time. So you want to be able to modulate. You don't want just quiet or excitatory. Sometimes you want to be able to modulate the other one. All right.